Welcome to Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. I'm Richard Dugan, your host. Thanks so much for joining us here. We come your way every Saturday from 3 to 4 p.m. Pacific time. We stream live at richarddugan.com and newspress.com. We are also rebroadcast on atozen.fm. You'll need to go to atozen.fm on the web and check their listings for the times and days when this program is replayed. We are archived at richarddugan.com, the radio show page, so lots of opportunities for you to hear the program. We also encourage you to get in touch with us as well as our guests. We'd like to know what you think of the program, as do our guests. And we'd also like to know if you have any ideas for upcoming broadcasts. I'm at no loss for ideas, but I'm always open to them. So please, please feel free to do that. The email address, richard@richarddugan.com. That's richard@richarddugan.com. You could even, because I do have the email address, send it to tellmeyourstory@richarddugan.com. That's tellmeyourstory@richarddugan.com. Today's program is going back to nature, if you will, and rightly so, because that's kind of the message we've been getting from so many of our guests over the weeks and months, is getting back to nature, in especially when it comes to centering yourself. Well, today we're going to be talking with the pollen queen, Noelle Mead Izzy, and she is going to share her passion for bees, birds, butterflies, and bats as the natural world faces unequivocal disruption and decline. And she's also going to deliver a message of spiritual pollination, as we call it. And Noelle, thank you so much for joining us on the program. Noelle Mead Izzy.
Thank you for having me, Richard.
It's nice to have you on the program and also to talk from this perspective, because certainly, I mean, probably the biggest news in the last 10 years is, of course, the issue regarding beehive collapse, if you will. That's just what they've been calling it. I have a feeling that the bees know exactly what they're doing, and that if we would only, in a manner of speaking, if we'd only change our ways, things might improve. And you are not only an author, but you're also a photographer as well. As a matter of fact, the photographs within the book Hummingbird, and that's the title, Hummingbird, The Hummingbird That Answered My Heart's Calling. That is the book that we're kind of featuring here on the program today. You took all the pictures in there as well. And I have to say that especially after a rain. And we were very fortunate in late February, early March of 2014 to have some nice rains here in Santa Barbara. I got to tell you that the greens were greener and you could hear the frogs in the distance. And correct me if I'm wrong, if you can hear frogs in the distance, then you know maybe possibly that your ecosystem locally is doing pretty good.
I'd like to think that the frogs are singing, the birds are singing, you know.
Yeah.
I think it's also an indicator that we're moving into the spring equinox pretty soon here.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, everything's coming alive and making its presence known. I'd like to think that, you know, in at least the smaller areas where people cultivate a safe and non-destructive habitat, that everything is doing its natural thing. So, yeah, it's wonderful to hear the frogs.
I know that, people are almost becoming frazzled to the point of frantic, if you will, if that's even possible, over what's going on with our environment. I'm not disagreeing with environmentalists and those who are concerned about what's going on. At the same time, there are certain instances where sometimes logic is just being thrown out for the sake of saving the environment, in that, and I'm almost not in a place to necessarily disagree that maybe we should just get out of some of these places that we're living in. I sometimes wonder about even where we live. We live up in the wilderness above Santa Barbara, and I'm going, should we really be up here? I mean, it's beautiful, and we're doing everything we can to maintain what's here. But, you know, I sometimes wonder. But then again, you know, you could say that about every piece of land on the planet, because the animals have been everywhere long before man ever came along.
Mm-hmm.
So where do we go? I mean, that's sort of the $64 million question is, okay, if we accept the scenarios that are being painted for us, where do we go? What do we do? How do we live and continue to have presence on the planet? I mean, how do we find that equilibrium?
Well, I definitely don't think that the purpose in any way is to run from it. It's to stay right there in the center of it and fix it. Because that's the problem, is we need what I call a coalition of the willing. We need people, and nature, one of the things that nature is so perfect at is balance. And so we have to come back to a balance in our thinking, like you were saying. We don't want to be extreme one way, and we don't want to be extreme the other way, because the problem with that is you alienate when you're on either side. And what we need to do is come together, be grounded, be centered in our knowing, go within, and do the right thing. You know, take guided action. Trust that if it doesn't feel right, it's not right. But we have to get the collective. We've got to get the, you know, as the Buddhists say, the 100th monkey. We have to get the mass population to get on board and to say, yes, enough is enough. And not to create strife around it, but to be in harmony around it, like everything in nature. You know, one of the things in our environment is consumption. You know, we freely and openly call ourselves consumers. We don't understand the energetic signature associated with that word being a consumer. That means, it implies that we take and we don't give back. There's mm-hmm. nothing in nature that doesn't naturally take what it needs and only what it needs and give something in return for the betterment of the whole. And humans have completely lost their way in that area in our lives. Mm-hmm. We either take too much or we give too much. And so we're either depleted of our energy for being givers, and then we may even become, you know, a martyr, or we take too much and we destroy everything around us through our greed. So it's not running from anywhere. It's not saying, well, I don't know about this. Okay, so this is no longer safe. Let me move over to this. Well, this is no longer safe or good. Let me move over to this. I believe we're being called upon. That's why you said there's a consciousness rising around this, because people are starting to realize we are going to be our own detriment. Everything that's happening in our environment is of our own doing. And the only thing suffering is nature and wildlife at large. But we're not called human nature by accident. We are part of that nature whole, and we will be destroyed as well.
Well, it's real interesting that you go in that direction. And of course, not wanting to continue the, not that I necessarily perceive the direction that you and I are conversing here as a downward spiral per se. We like to try to keep things up and optimistic and so forth, and we'll get there. But at the same time, I've often said this on this program, not necessarily in the context of speaking throughout an entire program about the natural world, but just asking the question, show me what species other than man on the planet behaves in the way that man behaves as a consumer producer, that hoards, that does the things that we do. Show me one species, not one can you show me, that does what we do. Some will say, well, what, look at the ants or look at the squirrels in the fall. They're gathering up all these nuts. And I say, yeah, but how long are they gathering those nuts for? How long are they gathering those various bits and pieces of what they will consume during the cold winter time when they can't get out and find food? For one season and one season only. They don't plan that far ahead. They don't have to.
Right. They trust. And it's funny, because I don't know if it was you that we had this conversation, but interesting that you mentioned the squirrel, because squirrels, most people think that they are hoarders, or that they take and they bury and it's like, oh, you know, mine, mine, mine. Squirrels, for the most part, only remember where they've hidden 10% of their little treats whatever it is that they're gathering, nuts or anything from pine cones and whatever. They only remember where they buried 10% of it. The other 90% stays in the ground and reseeds. So it's almost like acute, they're almost like just adorable little cartoon characters that are a little bit whimsical and kind of scatterbrained,
yeah,
because they do what they need to do and they survive from it. But what they don't take is automatically given back to the environment. So that seed or that nut or whatever it is that they're hiding that they don't go back to and pick up, you know, when it's time because they can't remember, grows into another, you know, tree or a plant, you know, some kind of horticulture.
Yeah.
So it's that's innate.
Here's an interesting change in mindset that I had. When we first moved here to Santa Barbara, the property on which we live and rent has 3 apple trees and a pear tree in very close proximity to the cottage that we live in. And the first season, of course, the pear tree gave forth fruit, and the sweetest pears. I'm not a big pear eater, but boy, I tell you what, I could have eaten all of them off the tree.
Mm-hmm.
But when the fruit started to fall, I said, we've got to gather this up. I mean, we can't let this go to waste. And of course, I just felt terrible. And this went on for 2 or 3 seasons until I finally understood that it isn't going to waste. That even though it might decay, you know, and it smells bad for a while, it goes back into the ground to nourish the apple tree from which it came. And so it recycles back through the trunk and up into the branches and the buds and so forth, and more apples come.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was at that point that I realized, okay, so even if I pull one apple off of that tree and all the rest of them fall to the ground, nothing's lost.
Absolutely. We're the only species on the planet that wastes. Nothing else wastes anything. It's a perfect planet. I mean, it really is. It sustains us, and it's in every way, it's perfection. But we were given the opportunity as human beings to think, you know, and have a conscious thought process to hopefully to affect the greater good in a positive way. So I believe that's our job. I mean, interesting enough, the honeybee, you know, we were talking about the pollinators and colony collapse disorder and so on. You know, unique among all creatures, only the honeybee improves the environment and preys not on any other species.
Now, this is rather interesting because I keep hearing different stories about the honeybee.
Mm-hmm.
It, as far as what I have heard, the honeybee was not indigenous to the North American continent. It was brought here from Europe. And again, I don't know if that's true or not, but that's what I'd heard. So I'm thinking, well, then what was pollinating the plants and trees and fruits and vegetables here in North America before they brought the honeybee over here? And of course, there are different birds and insects and all these other different things. And even the wind could conceivably, I suppose, just by moving the plants, could possibly get some of that pollen down into where it's supposed to be. I don't know the answer to that question. Maybe you do.
Well, I would like to say that, that's a pretty strong statement that, you know, they were purposely brought here from Europe, that there was no other type of bee here that was a pollinating bee. If you consider the fact that a worker bee, In a honeybee hive, the average worker bee produces about 1/12 teaspoon of honey in her lifetime, which is usually about 6 weeks in high season, you know, spring and summer.
Mm-hmm.
A hive of bees will fly 90,000 miles, which is the equivalent of about 3 orbits around the Earth.
Wow.
To collect 1 kilogram of honey. And in order for them to sustain the hive, it takes 1 ounce of honey to fuel a bee's flight around the world. But in order to sustain the hive, the larva, the 2,500 eggs per day that the queen lays, these honeybees have to travel far. I mean, they visit 50 to 100 flowers during one collection trip.
Wow.
So these are the planet's workhorses. I mean, they're so tiny.
And they get no frequent flyer miles either.
Exactly. So for that, whoever made that statement, I'm not saying it's not right. I haven't gone back that far, because the creatures of the planet have been here far longer than we have.
Right.
So I'm not going to refute it. However, I'm just going to say that the traveling of the honeybees is so vast that it kind of seems like a very narrow, opinion about the honeybee.
I also remember hearing too that based on basic aerodynamics, the honeybee should not be able to fly. This is something else I had heard.
There is no way
that with our knowledge of aerodynamics that the bee should even be in the air.
Mm-hmm.
And yet,
yeah,
guess what? It's in the air.
Yeah, and its body size,
its
wing size is, in proportion to their body size, so small that scientists can't figure it out, which that in and of itself is just like, there are things that we may have been quote-unquote written, however, we want to look at this, that the human beings had dominion, were given dominion over the animals. But it's interesting because there are still things out there, there's still just life forces out there that we humans just can't quite figure it out. And I think we're not supposed to figure it out, because I think there's supposed to be a sense of awe, a childlike sense of awe and gratitude for the natural world around us. Because if we know everything, or if we think we know everything, where's the magic anymore?
Yeah. Well, I've used the analogy that, let's just say for the sake of argument, that there are 10,000 laws of the universe. Science discovers 10 of them and says, we know it all now. And then the following year, they discover 11, and now we know it all. And I just sit there in marvel, because I hear about physics, and now I'm hearing, of course, for the last, 10 or 20, or I don't know how many years, quantum was regular physics not good enough? So you had to put quantum in front of it? And what's the significant difference between the two? I just, drives me crazy. But one of the things that I have found so interesting, having moved here to Santa Barbara, having moved to where we live, as well as the city, and of course, I mean, walking distance of the beach from my place of work, which is fantastic. The connection that I mentioned at the beginning of the program that many of our guests have referred to in terms of recentering one's self. Talk to us about that.
Recentering. I interchange that word with grounding.
Okay, same thing.
Same thing. So I'm just going to go to the genesis of the experience I had with the hummingbird. And what happened was it took place during the market crash of 2008. And like every other American or people in the world, that other countries that were affected by this, I was living in just this hyper sense of movement. I was in corporate and I was starting my own company and I bought my own house and I was, everything was moving so fast, and that was fine. So I thought that was fine. And I wasn't grounded. I was just kind of like just going along almost like on a breeze. What do they call that? Like a sheep following the herd all the time. And then, there's a wrench in the spoke that happens worldwide and countrywide, and that's this crash. So everybody around us is going into panic mode. People are losing their retirement, their homes, their jobs, their cars, everything. And so what happens to someone who's not centered or grounded or isn't in a place where to be in a state of non-attachment, it doesn't mean that you can't have visions for yourself, but it just means don't be attached to the outcome, because there's always that chance for great disappointment. So for someone who wasn't grounded and centered in herself, I began to experience horrible, horrible panic attacks, you know, whereby I thought I was having a heart attack and dying. And so outside of going to see my doctor who, you know, told me the good news is it can't kill you, and we can certainly put you on anti-anxiety drugs, I wasn't prepared to do the anti-anxiety drug at the time. So what I wanted to do was find that inner healing, that centeredness and the groundedness that we speak of right now. And this creature who is in perfect balance, the hummingbird, is symbolic of joy and beauty and sweetness. I mean, it survives off nectar, and nectar comes from the most beautiful things in the world, flowers. But what these animals and these creatures and these pollinators do, as I mentioned before, is they live in a perfect state of balance. Every single time that hummingbird would come back to the nest to feed its baby with the nectar from these flowers, every time it went to a flower, it redistributed pollen in order to give back. It was centered and grounded in its life. Even when, and in the book I mentioned, the Santa Ana winds that come through California, and I think where you live, you experience
them
too.
We get them too, yes.
Yeah. I mean, at night, when her nestling had hatched and she was, you know, keeping it warm and sitting on top of the nest, in the middle of the night, these Santa Ana winds would blow so fiercely that the branch that her nest was on would just be thrashing. You know, I described it like a buoy in a hurricane, if you can, like, visualize what that looks like in the middle of the ocean. And she would just be thrashing about. And I would look out at her, and there was no, she wouldn't, like, lift up off the nest. There was no panic in her energy at all. She just remained calm, centered, and grounded. And she would just go with the flow. And she, you know, and her baby was safe underneath her.
Mm-hmm.
And the winds would stop and back to normal. And these are the aha moments in this experience that I would say, how is it that the smallest bird known to man, almost seemingly insignificant, A, because they're so, hummingbirds are so elusive. They're so fast, you almost don't even see them.
Mm-hmm.
And then to have the tiniest bird known to man build a nest the size of a walnut shell, you don't even notice those things. So here this is, this bird who's teaching me, who's showing me, hey, you got something to learn here, my friend. You are not centered. You have no trust. You're completely off balance here. And as the experience took hold and I was journaling and I was photographing and I was having these aha moments, it changed my life. I mean, something seemingly so insignificant was extraordinary in my healing, because suddenly, as time went on, this beautiful distraction, I call her, I didn't have my panic attacks. I was focused on something other than my own, you know, self, woe is me. You know, I was looking at the world around me and appreciating. And as soon as you start living or putting yourself in a state of really deep, profound gratitude, suddenly things start to look lighter. Life starts to be better. And, you know, you just feel like you're more empowered. And so that's what this experience did for me. And so when we talk about being centered, that's where I think people lose that balance in their life. They spin in one direction or the other. They don't appreciate the world around them, this free admission world around us. You walk outside, there's no cover charge. There's no admission fee. It's all right there at your fingertips to enjoy. And we've been given this great gift. Enjoy it. Learn from it.
Yeah, it's to me just incredible. I mean, granted, it doesn't matter where you live as a human being, for the most part, those of us who want to live in some kind of a warm and sheltered structure, you're going to have to pay for that. But if you can get up into the woods, you can get to a park, you can get to where we live, you get to the beach, there's no charge. You know, you can walk out to the end of the pier if you want and just listen to the water slapping up against the supports of the pier. Or go down to the shore and listen to the waves rolling in, or wherever it is that you can get to. I think that's incredible. I really do. When we get back, I want to talk a little bit about the symbolism, totems in particular. We're going to continue on with Noelle Mead Izzy, and we're going to talk more about her book and the work that she is sharing with us today. It's called The Hummingbird That Answered My Heart's Calling. Noelle Mead Izzy is my guest. I'm Richard Dugan, and you are listening to Tell Me Your Story.
We leave here today. We could be 1,000 miles away. Take to that road. See how road, all the countries in our bones, all the trouble that you know empties out as you go.
Welcome back to Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. I'm Richard Dugan, your host. Thanks so much for staying with us as we continue talking with Noelle Mead Izzy about her work and her book, The Hummingbird That Answered My Heart's Calling. I had an experience not too long ago, Noelle, that was whenever I have animals cross my path, I don't care if it's a bird or a land animal, I often wonder, what did that mean? And I had two of them very close together. Now, I have another guest who we've had on the program talk about totems, but I want to get your perspective on this. I was driving back from picking up dinner for my wife and I at the local tavern down below where we live. It's kind of a convenience. It's really kind of nice. And I'm driving back. It's a nice, cool, cloudy evening. And I'm not going real fast. And all of a sudden, I see a deer bolt across the roadway in front of me. Again, not going fast, I slowed down and I actually stopped. And then two, and then three, and then four.
Wow.
Shot across the road back up into the hills.
Wow.
And I just sat there. Not because, oh my God, I could have hit. That wasn't where I was at. It was, wow, just like what you just said.
Mm-hmm.
The next day, we were heading for work. We had just come down off the hill off of 154 on the straightaway. And again, far enough in front so that I wasn't going to hit the animal. I'm pretty sure my wife didn't see it. She was looking at something else at that moment. A fox ran across the road in front of me. And I wasn't, oh my God, I almost hit him. It was, wow, what did that mean? How do we find out about what these signs? Because these, first of all, I don't use the word coincidence.
No.
I use the word coincidence.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
I believe in coincidences.
Mm-hmm.
Things that coincide. My presence and the fox's or the deer's presence at the same place, our paths coincide. They came together.
Right.
First of all, is there? I'm just curious on a personal level. Is there any insight you can give me on those two incidences? But then expand on that in terms of how we, as individuals, could tap into an understanding of why that animal, at that moment, chose to cross our path.
Well, we can go very broad and we can narrow it. So if you, and this, in, you know, we have a deep, deep sense of knowing, you know, our higher self, our intuition. We have that. And so first and foremost, it's a matter of using that and just, you know, allowing yourself to just, what if you just ask the question, you know, what did that mean? And you allow the answer to come to you without overthinking it, without trying to find some scientific, you know, answer on, you know, Google search or whatever. if you look within and say, well, Okay, so I'm going to take your deer experience. You can go in and look at deer symbolism. Okay, that's one aspect. You can think about, was there anything at the time that this happened that I was pondering in my mind? And having this experience with the deer, if I go back and think, what was I thinking at that moment? Is this a confirmation of something I was thinking about that was, a positive thing on my life path, or something that I, this had to halt me to pay attention to what I was thinking at that moment? Or we can just, if it's something like the deer run across and you're in awe, complete awe, and that's all it is it just brings you back to a place where you remember that we coexist, that we are part of the divine whole. That's good enough. If you have a really, like the fox, it's not common to see a fox. The song, What Does the Fox Say? Well, what does the fox say? Well, I know, first and foremost, foxes represent adaptability. If a fox crosses your path and you're like, wow, this is really strange, it's animal symbolism, totem will tell you that things are happening, changes are taking place, and you need to adapt, because fox is a great adapter.
Mm.
For me, the hummingbird showed up, and the symbolism of hummingbird is, joy, beauty, lightness of being, resilience, playfulness. It's all those kind of things. But when I decided to name this hummingbird, Artemis, I remember pulling out a deck of goddess cards that a woman named Doreen Virtue has as part of her books, and she has these cards that are like, of the ancient goddesses of all cultures, Greek and Hindu and whatever. And I always like to read about the different goddesses of the times on our earth, what they symbolize, who they were. And I remember shuffling the cards, but a couple days after I was introduced to this hummingbird, I felt like I was building a connection with her. And so I decided to name her, but I didn't know what to name her. So I thought, well, gosh, you're so happy. And I looked at the symbolism and you represent joy and beauty and all that. But for some reason that just, that was okay. But I wanted to know, who are you? Like, what's your MO here? And so I shuffled these goddess cards. And this is going back to when I talked about not having attachment to the outcome. For some reason, I was expecting, as I was shuffling the cards, to have the outcome of a card coming up. And I asked the hummingbird, what is your name? Who are you? Who do you want to be called? And I thought she was going to say, some really beautiful goddess name like Athena. I pull up Athena. And when I shuffled the cards and pulled out a card, the card was Artemis. And I was like, Artemis? Wow, I've never even heard of a goddess named Artemis. And the image on the card was of kind of a tomboy looking woman. And she was surrounded at her feet, almost like St. Francis of Assisi. She was surrounded by a bunch of animals, and she was out in nature, and she had this bow and arrow. And the card described Artemis as a Greek goddess, and that she was the guardian goddess of nature, and that she used her bow and arrow not for bad, not to hurt or destroy anything, but it was a bow and arrow that kept her focused, always focused on her goal and her mission in life, and that was protecting and looking over the animals. And so I look over at this little hummingbird in the nest, and I thought, okay, you're Artemis. That is who you are. That's the energy that you want me to know, that I need to be a guard. Like, Artemis was a guardian. This hummingbird was completely a guardian over her own life and her baby's life, but she was a strong, independent little creature that had no fear and was on a mission, and she showed it every day. I mean, if you ever watch a hummingbird for 3 months in the whole process, they are focused.
Yeah.
They know what is expected of them, and they do it. And that's who she was. So for me, when you talk about animal symbolism, there's all kinds of ways to look at animals and how they show up and what they do for us.
It's where your intuition comes into play. And I think that's, we talk about that a lot on this program. I'm not sure if my guests talk as much about it as I do, but nonetheless, my wife has three different feeders for birds. She has a finch feeder, she has a regular wild bird feeder, and then she has a hummingbird feeder. And all three of them are right around and above the front door entrance that into the cottage where we live. And if you're not careful, you'll hit the hummingbird feeder with the door, and the liquid goes all over the place, but, you know, so be it. But it's one of those things where and these birds can be very messy at times, seed all over the ground, but it doesn't go to waste.
No.
It's quite extraordinary, I must say. As a matter of fact, we had chickens up until December 14th of 2012, and we lost all of our hens, 16 or 17 of them, and so I have this giant container of chicken feed.
Mm.
And so what I'm going to do, I didn't, and we also had a peahen, and I wasn't sure if she would eat the feed, if I'd have to get her something special, but she did, and she actually laid some eggs for us too, which was, they were huge. I couldn't believe it.
Aww.
And as I say, we lost the whole flock on the 14th back in December of 2012. And so what I'm going to do is, we're going to kind of do a little test. I'm going to take a cupful and I'm going to just spread it out in one area to see if the birds and or the animals will eat it. If they will, then I'm going to go ahead and distribute it because I don't want to just throw it away.
No, something will eat it.
Yeah, and I want to be sort of, I'm not sure what the word is, but I want to spread it around. I want to share it with whoever wants to share it instead of just pile it up in one spot.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, but it's... When we first got the hens, we would go down to the chicken coop and the run that I built for them, and my wife would sit on a chair outside the chicken run with a glass of wine in the Santa Barbara style.
Mm-hmm.
I would go inside the chicken run, sit down on a little stool that I had in there, and they would jump up on my knee.
Oh.
And it was just the most incredible experience that we ever had. And certainly, even to this day, we even talk about them and, you know, how we miss them and what have you. But I have to say that the more I hear these kinds of stories of what you're sharing in your book and our conversation, the more the further away from the city I want to get.
Mm-hmm.
Almost the more disconnected, the more off the grid, the more out of touch I want to be, in a manner of speaking. And maybe not literally, but certainly you can understand. And I mean, this is to me, I the only inkling I ever had to being a farmer, and having chickens is part of farming, was when I was 19 and I took an aptitude test. And of all things, growing up and being born and raised in the city of Phoenix, the aptitude test said I should be a farmer.
Wow.
I do not know how that came out, but be that as it may, here I am today. Talk to us also. You have. And I was looking at this, and I was trying to pronounce it, and I'm sitting here going phonetically, and put it together. Benevolent, the website, and you have products, BEE-NEVOLENT.com is a website you can go to find about Benevolent products. It says here, enable children and adults to give back to the Bee Nation. Now, how do we do that? Should I? Because I know some people here in Santa Barbara that I could get a beehive from, and put it up in our area.
Oh, that would be lovely.
You know,
I mean, if everybody, I think one of the first things we have to teach, and that's adults and children, is to dispel the fear. Now, I am not saying that you're going to walk up to a black widow spider and gently remove it from its web,
right,
and let it crawl across your finger and say, oh, how I love you, okay?
Well, first of all, I would address that real quickly by saying, why would you do that? You're removing the spider from its natural environment. Leave the spider where it is. Admire it from afar.
Right, exactly. But my point is, you know, I completely agree. I have a very hard time killing I mean, I don't. Yeah. That's all there is to it. I just simply don't. If there's something living in my home that belongs outside, I will take it outside. I will absolutely not kill it in any way, shape, or form. But what I'm saying is there's a fear.
Yeah.
There's a fear around a lot of creatures and animals. And what we have to do is dispel that because, okay, I want to just touch on what you said about you wanting to move away from this city. What's happening on this planet is people are becoming more and more sensitive to stimuli, and stimuli that doesn't resonate with their vibration, with who they are in their natural state of well-being.
Yeah.
And this, of course, I'm sure we know this has been going on for you know, over time, over a long period of time, but it's really, really becoming more apparent now. We just left the Piscean age, and we entered into the Aquarian age, and we did that in 2013.
Yeah.
And each age is like, what, 25, 26,000 years or something
yeah.
like that.
Mm-hmm.
And so the Piscean age was all about control over, conquering over. The Aquarian age, just like the fifth dimension saying way back when we were little kids listening to our parents' LPs, mm-hmm. was, you know, the age of Aquarius where, you know, we're going to see a shift, a huge shift. Now, we could look around and say, well, gee, I don't see that happening. Things look like they're getting worse.
Yeah.
But we're still scrubbing away the Piscean energy, but we are moving into the Aquarian age. And the perfect example are the people that are very sensitive to the Piscean stimuli.
Yeah.
And so we want to commune and not conquer. And so, you know, when we talk about the fear, we have to dispel the fear of the bees. You know, everything is energy, but it's becoming more and more strong, whereby the energy will lead the physical action, as opposed to before when physical action and energy kind of followed. That's not how it's meant to be, and scientifically and spiritually that's not what it is, but we perceive it that way. I need to take action, and then I will see something happen. What we need to do now and encourage is to have the right action in our heart, in our mind, in our vibration, in our energy, and the action will follow. We will see everything manifest intangible. So dispel the fear of the hive. Dispel the fear of the bee. Remember that a honeybee will give of its life to protect itself when it feels threatened. When it stings you, you might sting, get stung, and God forbid anybody, you know, that's allergic to bees would ever, you know, die from it. I mean, I'm not saying be foolish.
No.
But remember, every bee dies when it stings.
Yeah.
So it gives of itself. So it's not doing this out of spite and hatred. It's doing it out of just a fear that feels threatened, protection. So having a hive, oh my gosh. I mean, that is so symbolic and so beautiful and spiritual to have a hive where you get to watch the harmonious, integrated, unified workings of the honeybee, the cooperation that these bees, thousands of them. It's beautiful. I encourage it. I say go do it.
You know, it's interesting that this subject comes up because when I was a kid growing up and being legally blind at that time, I was afraid of flying insects, flies, bees, wasps, whatever they were. Now, when I hear before I see a bumblebee or honeybee fluttering around the flowers or even the hummingbird feeder, which they will do, I say hello. I say, hey, thanks for being here. This is fabulous that it's a mixed. It's fabulous that you're here because you're pollinating, but it's fabulous that you're here and you're still alive.
You know, and I are on the same length.
You know,
and like, oh my gosh, yes.
And we had, and speaking of the issue of attitude around wild animals, we have, because of where we live, we had a bear walk through our property, the property we're on. And our neighbor managed to get some pictures, but my wife and I had a first-hand encounter with the bear. As you know, with having chickens at the time at this particular point in time in our lives, you know, we had one or two that had passed, and of course I have to take care of the aftermath. And yeah. So I go up the hill and I'm dispatching the hens, and I hear this rustling way over to my left, on the side of the road, the dirt road in the property, and I stop because I don't know what it is, because there's no barking, so it's not a, you know, usually a dog would bark if it hears you or this kind of thing. All of a sudden, this brown bear stands up and he looks at me, and I look at him. And I figure, okay, you're there eating the plums off the tree or that have fallen, what have you. I've got work to do, so I'm going to go on my way and leave you. And there was no fear. I took care of my business, and I headed back down the hill towards the house. I've told this story a couple times. My wife says, so what's going on? I said, well, I'm just cleaning up the chicken coop, but I just saw the bear. The bear? I want to see the bear. I said, well, hang on a second. Let me finish. So I had to finish up a couple things at the chicken coop. Did that. We walked back up the hill. She was already 20 feet ahead of me. And we got to the top of the hill. There was the rustling again. The bear looked up again the same way he did the first time. Only this time, there was a bit of annoyance. Like, you know, I'm trying to eat, and I like to eat in privacy. So if you're not going to leave me alone, I'm just going to leave. So what he did was, he walked out from behind the bushes, walked in front of us across the road, about 20 feet in front of us, walked out onto the access, the paved road, and headed down towards, and most people in this area would know, headed down towards the tavern. And it was just the wildest thing. My wife has seen a buck run past the backside of the cottage. Matter of fact, so fast that he had hit his antlers on the telephone poles or the trees and the limbs as he was going by. Mm-hmm. But it didn't stop him.
Oh, heck no.
I mean, the things that we actually had a skunk burrow underneath the chicken coop and come up underneath, and we saw him in there with a flashlight. We let him be. You know, he eventually just burrowed back down and out. Mm-hmm. But, you know, we didn't disturb him. We figured, okay. I mean, we figure he's not the type of creature that's going to kill chickens.
No.
He's going to probably go for the eggs, if anything.
Right.
I mean, these kinds of experiences are not just priceless, but they're precious from the standpoint that I would not have had them if I'd stayed back in Phoenix, and I wouldn't have had that connection.
Right.
I'm curious as to your own upbringing. You shared with us, of course, in regards to the hummingbird, but if I may use some very poor metaphors and puns, what bee got into your bonnet, or what bug stung you that got you so interested in this? The reverse of that question is, why do you care so much? What difference does it make to you? Why don't you just take pictures and go about your life?
Well, I was raised in Southern California, probably about an hour south of Santa Barbara, a little inland from Ventura County in a city called Santa Clarita.
Yes.
And it was a very open space in the time that we moved there, and I was raised there, went to grade school, junior high, and high school, and stayed there really up until that point. I mean, I moved to Orange County for college and then lived there for about 5 years and then moved back to Santa Clarita when, you know, the relationship didn't work out and I was finished with school and now what was I going to do, you know? So I moved back home with my parents for a little while and they lived in that same house over there in Santa Clarita for about 33 years. It was a very open area when we moved there. It was called, my high school was actually called Cow Pie High because it was built, this was all agriculture. It was like, I don't know if are you familiar with the 126 Fillmore? And
I'm familiar with it from traffic reports, but I haven't driven up it. I've gone up 33 okay. towards Ojai and so forth.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's kind of that same. It was just a very open, it had orchards, it had agriculture, it was, you know, that kind of thing, which wasn't that attractive to teenagers because no teens had anywhere to go but like in the back of, you know, a dirt road 6 miles so no one would catch us, you know, playing music and drinking beer, you know.
Yeah.
But I remember just being the kind of person that enjoyed just putting on my tennis shoes and going for a run and just breathing in the air. And I would kind of daydream, and I'm sure a lot of people just did that, but I wasn't involved, if you will, with any kind of animal thing or nature thing. I mean, I know I appreciated it. I had dogs and cats and all that kind of stuff. But this is the interesting thing about when you ask what bee got in your bonnet, if you will, or what made you do this, or why did you do this? I think what it is I was just living my life. When the experience happened with Artemis, the hummingbird, I was just doing my thing. I went for walk. The reason why this experience happened at all was because I did regular walks outside in that area, and mm-hmm. it was really beautiful. And I would just talk and pray, whatever you want to call it, mm-hmm. to anything out there, the trees, the moon, the stars, the birds, you know, whatever, to please help me through this very difficult time in my life, these panic attacks, because I've never experienced anything like that before. And that's why this book is called The Hummingbird That Answered My Heart's Calling, because that's exactly what this animal did. She answered my prayer. She answered what I was yearning for, and that was, you know, a sense of well-being again. I was just, everything was spiraling out of control. So once this happened, I filed away my journal. I filed away all of my photographs and went about my life, still enjoying, you know, the outdoors, but really becoming in tune with my environment. And in the book, in the epilogue, I mention all of the things that started occurring once I was in alignment with this thing called nature and the goodness and the beauty of it in my own backyard. I was experiencing on a daily basis the extraordinary within the ordinary. And I say ordinary with, you know, quotations, because nothing out there is ordinary,
yeah.
but we perceive it that way. And so it just took on a life of its own. And now this is what I feel is my life's work. And I feel, honestly, that if I don't answer the calling of at least caring, at least in my own heart, caring about this stuff, I'll be destined to repeat it and come back and do it again.
Yeah, I think about that too. And it's like, I really don't want to do that.
Neither
it's bad
do
enough
I.
when you have to take a test. It's bad enough when you have to take a test that you didn't do so well on, and you maybe if you get the higher grade, we'll give that to you. Otherwise, you're going to be stuck with that one. Or you got to go through the DMV and take the test multiple times.
Yeah.
It's
one of those things that you feel like, you know, every individual on this planet, every animal and every human being has a purpose here, has a calling, has work to do here, has their life's work. And what's beautiful about nature is it's another teaching opportunity. It's another channel of wisdom that if we open up to it, because if I would have just ignored this nest, if I would have said, oh, like you said, oh, take a few pictures and, oh, that's a great hummingbird, and then went about the way I was before, this changed my life, really.
Yeah.
It changed my perspective, but then it changed my life's work, where the passion is so strong in me about getting this message of appreciating the natural world around us and the great gift it is, because nature is a teacher.
Yeah.
This bird taught me something very profound.
Yeah.
We have to preserve all of these great teachers. We can't destroy them, because if we don't listen, like we just said, and, you know, this is alluding to, you know, reincarnation.
Sure.
So I'm just saying. But, you know, we will be destined to come back, because if our life's work isn't completed, we get so many opportunities to come back and do it again and again. Isn't that wonderful?
Well, on the one hand, it's wonderful. But on the other hand, it's, are you kidding me?
Can yeah, we well, get I'm, it? Being, I'm being facetious.
Yeah, I know. Can we just get it done this time? You know?
Yeah. So, you know, and let me tell you, when you talk about intuition, it's interesting that you said that's something that you really believe in and you really live your life by intuition. Interesting enough, the deer is the quote-unquote the pathfinder, and the symbolism of deer is trust your instincts and your intuition.
Hmm.
So that's interesting that that was such a monumental experience that you had with these deer, and it made you go, whoa, because you're a guy who lives by and tries to embrace and teach others, trust your intuition.
Yeah.
Move through life with your intuition. It's our greatest ally.
And I always tell people, your intuition, and I don't care what you call it, the still small voice, your higher self, it will never, ever, 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 ever lead you into harm's way. It may challenge you. It may put you in challenging situations, but those situations will not harm you. It's there to teach you and guide you. And I was in an intensive years ago, and I was asked to write something down on this 12-inch by 6-inch or 4-inch piece of white construction paper, a promise or what have you that I was going to make to myself. And having to do with intuition, and I still have it too, by the way, it said basically that I promise to listen to, and then in all caps, and follow. What good does it do to listen to your intuition, to your gut, if you're not going to follow it? It's like, if you're not going to follow it, then stop listening. I'm not kidding. I really mean that. If you're not going to, then stop listening. Go ahead and dive into whatever the world has for you in that regard. Because, you know, you're wasting your time. Your intuition's going anywhere. It's always going to be there for you.
Mm-hmm.
It's your friend. It's there to help you. I'm going to throw out a couple of quick things to you, and I'm going to ask what your initial reaction would be. And let's just say that you are in a relationship. You both lose your jobs. You don't know it yet, but the housing market in your area is about to collapse. And again, you don't know this yet. You have a fairly good-sized nest egg in terms of deciding that you could move somewhere else. What would your basic emotions at that particular point be?
So,
Your job. That would generate a great deal of fear, wouldn't it?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
But I don't know, the market crash is coming, right?
That's right.
Okay. Well, obviously, yes, the losing your job does create a large sense of fear. I have actually been in that situation.
Mm-hmm.
So, thankfully, there was, over years, I had cultivated a little bit more trust and just saying, okay, here's the situation, but know that there's a reason for this. And it sounds cliche. I know it does.
Mm-hmm.
But there's a reason for this. And though my mind and my ego is saying, oh my God, panic mode, turn it on, cortisol, stress, you know, da-da-da-da, this is doomsday, what's going to happen now? The other part of me that over time has cultivated an awareness, a self-awareness, and an understanding of my connection, that everything was going to be okay. There's a reason why this is happening.
Mm-hmm.
There is an opportunity of a door that is starting to open up. And so if I don't know what that is right now, which I didn't, just give it a little bit of time. Sit with what you're feeling.
Mm-hmm.
Be okay. I mean, if you have moments of fear and panic, it's okay. No one's saying that you have to be, you know, this perfect sage here on earth that, you know, just floats through it. We're here on this learning planet for a reason. No one said it's going to be super easy until it does become super easy when we all become enlightened.
Right.
And so I just kind of sat with it. And sure enough, all of these little tiny aspects and nuances of my life started to fall and place themselves. And here I am now. I'm not destitute. I don't have the 9-to-5 job anymore, but I'm more fulfilled and my life is more enriched and more good keeps flowing into my life in terms of, I'm not saying that money isn't important, and I certainly love money. And one of the things people have to not do is be afraid of money or speak badly about money, because it's money is energy.
Yeah.
It's like anything else. If you have a friend and you constantly tell them, I don't like you, you're evil, I don't want you in my life, everybody that has you in their life are evil, do you think that friend's going to come knocking on your door and go, hey, can I come over for dinner?
Really?
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And money's the same thing. It's not evil. It's actually a really wonderful opportunity to serve and to be gracious and receive and be happy. So things just started falling into place and putting me on a path that was I was ready for, a new chapter, a new level of enrichment, and a new part of my journey in my life's work. So that, you know, I've had that happen to me a couple times. The first time it happened was the market crash of 2008, where I wasn't even literally affected by it. This is what's the crazy part, is I didn't lose my job. I had started my own company and started building a client base. I hadn't lost the client base, but I feared I would. I hadn't lost my house, but I feared I would.
Mm-hmm.
I hadn't lost my savings, but I feared I would.
Mm.
And all of the what ifs is what brought me to the physical ailment of panic.
Wow. Well, I can tell you that in 2006, those things actually happened. I lost my job to the sale of the station I was working for. On the 28th of February was my last day. I was cleaning out my desk on March 1st. My wife calls me at 2 o'clock in the afternoon and says, I just quit my job. And in my head, I'm screaming, do you know where that I'm unemployed too? You know, but we were sitting watching TV that night and she came up to and it was interesting. In spite of all of that happening, I felt absolutely no fear. And we're sitting in front of the TV that evening watching, and she comes over, sits and says, I'm really feeling kind of panicky and scared. What are we going to do? And I told her, I says, you know, of all of the people I've interviewed and the workshops and seminars and intensives and everything that I've been through and all of the CDs and blah, blah, blah that I've taken in, they all say the same thing about a situation like this. When you come to the edge of what she said, she felt like we were on a precipice or cliff, you do two things. The first is you jump. And the second is you trust. And the next thing I knew, we went on a weeks-long vacation to Santa Barbara to see what we could find and enjoy ourselves. Went back to Phoenix, put the house up for sale. We were out of Phoenix May 8th at 2:30 in the afternoon. And we drove into our new place here in Santa Barbara 12 hours later on the 9th, 2:30 in the morning, up on the hill above Santa Barbara in the fog. And it's interesting. There's only one other time when I had no fear, and that was when we were in Ireland. And there's this cliff, literal cliff, on the edge of one of the Aran Islands, Inishmore. And we were there, and it was a granite fort that had been built. And there was this big slab of granite that hung out over the edge of the cliff. And I wanted to go out to the edge and take some pictures of the ocean and the sides of the cliff. Having no fear whatsoever, I crawled out there, sat with my feet dangling over the edge, taking pictures. And I came back off of that thing, and we went home back to our little cottage there on the island we were staying. It wasn't until 10 o'clock that night that the fear hit me. And there I was, safe and snug and warm inside my bed, inside a stone cottage on our vacation, and I was afraid then of falling off of that cliff.
Wow.
That was bizarre, to say the very least. But before we wrap things up, I want to remind our listeners that they can get a hold of you through a website, benevolent.com, and Noelle Mead Izzy is my guest, and her book is The Hummingbird that Answered My Heart's Calling. And I have three final questions to ask you before we wrap up. I know your time is valuable and precious, and so we'll get to them. Who is Noelle Mead Izzy?
Is that a trick question, Richard?
No.
As you mean, as someone, as I would describe myself?
The response that I would give to people who ask me that question is, trust your intuition.
I am an avid, hopelessly romantic nature lover that feels elevated by it, and I want so badly to share that and teach that to others so that they will find the most profound joy in the things in life that are free for now, and to lovingly be faithful stewards to the natural world around us so that for generations to come, we'll all be elevated through it.
And what is it that you hope to or want to achieve through the work that you're doing?
Okay. To reach the masses. I mean, to have a critical mass of people that are collectively, a coalition of the willing that are collectively understanding how truly powerful we are as human beings in affecting real change. And it starts in our heart and with our energy and our intention. It doesn't, you don't have to fly over to Africa to picket in front of poachers that destroy our beautiful elephants for their tusk. And I'm just sort of throwing this out.
Sure.
You, when someone says, I have no power, I have no control over this, to that I say, you're more powerful than you know. So each day, sit quietly, close your eyes, and just with your thoughts and your mind, imagine a world with abundant elephants roaming the African plains safe in safe herds, and nobody is touching them. Everybody is admiring their presence here. And the same with anything else that you love in our natural world, and people too.
Yeah.
Just do that, because we are, like I said, we are now moving into a stronger and stronger energetic space on this planet. It will start with our intention, and then the action will follow.
And your intuition has answered my third question, how powerful are we as human beings? And with that, I want to thank you so much, Noelle Meadizzi, for joining us on the program, sharing your story and your insights. And I invite you, when you're in the Santa Barbara area, to come in studio and we'll do a face-to-face interview.
Oh, that would be fabulous. And I love Santa Barbara. And I thank you so much for taking this time to speak with me and connect with me. That was really wonderful.
Well, thank you. I'm Richard Dugan. Again, the book is entitled The Hummingbird That Answered My Heart's Calling, and the website, I've got it right here, is benevolent.com. That's benevolent.com. And we encourage people to get in touch with you as well through your website. And again, I thank you so much for your time. Beautiful work that you do and photographically. And again, I hope that we see you here in Santa Barbara one day.
Sounds wonderful.
I'm Richard Dugan. This has been Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World, giving you choices and knowledge of those choices to help make your dreams come true. Until next time, love Talal.